Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
In April 2014, 19-year-old Shane Carthy seemed to have it all. One of the best young Gaelic footballers in the country, an All-Ireland winner with Dublin, he'd just been awarded Man of the Match in a Leinster Under-21 final. But just 2 weeks later, Shane found himself in St Patrick's Mental Health Services being treated for severe depression after 2 years of inner turmoil that led him to consider taking his own life. Shane's long and difficult path to recovery is a harrowing but inspirational story that resonates far beyond sport. He's told it now in a book called Dark Blue, in the hope, as he puts it, that he might light the path for others suffering as he once did. Shane, great to have you with us and thanks for talking to us.
Thanks.
And congratulations on the book. Growing up as a young boy in Portmarnock, you were, as you put it in the book, you were on a pedestal. In the views of others, obsessed with sport, driven for success. When did you first realise as a child that you had, as one of your coaches put it, something special about you?
I think it was, if I was to think back now, in my primary school days, you know, at the sports day, I remember my first kind of aspiration was to be awarded Junior Sports Boy of the Year in third class. And looking back now, it's a funny thing because like it's absolutely not such a big deal. But in around that time, that was the seriousness that I took my sport in. And I guess that kind of talent for any sport that I threw my hand at was echoed at sports day, where I picked up my first Junior Sports Boy of the Year and coincided then with 4 years of success at that particular rate. So I guess when I realised I had something, as you say, quote-unquote special, was in and around that kind of primary school days of third to sixth class, where I was like, OK, there's something that I want to go after here, in particular Gaelic football, where granted in a smaller context, by the end of sixth class, my Dublin career would have began. You know, when I was representing the North Dublin team. So I guess that was my first realisation and my first kind of love for a proper sport in the shape of Gaelic football, where it began in around then.
And you had this drive to be the best that you could be at it. You refer several times to your dad saying that if you're going to do something, do it to the best of your ability. And that was almost like a mantra for you growing up.
Yeah, and I seen, you know, I think it was as a kind of manifestation of seeing what my dad was doing in his life. He was hugely hard working. He'd worked for Advanced Tire Pitstop for 30 plus years, and I'd heard about the many, many stories where he wouldn't even come to my sister's games because he was working so hard. And, yeah. You know, in his later life, he kind of, you know, took work less seriously. And that's where he kind of came into my life, in particular in the sporting context. And I just tried to, you know, mirror what he was doing in his general life, and in particular for sport, as he said, anything you do, do it to your best of your ability. So that's what I was trying to do from a very early age. I was probably years ahead of where I should have been at 11 and 12 and having that drive to be the best that I could be. But I guess that put me in good stead for the years to come thereafter.
So you're in your teenage years. You mentioned you were representing Dublin from primary school stage. You go on representative teams. You talk about it giving you an air of invincibility. Yeah. That was all part of being what a Dublin footballer meant. So how much of your identity was wrapped up in your sporting life?
I think at that stage my whole identity was, according to me anyway, I guess I was so tunnel vision in the fact that nothing else was going on in my world. It was only Gaelic football, it was sport in general, but in particular Gaelic football, as you say. I was lucky enough to represent the Dublin development teams all the way through from, you know, under 12s onwards, and I was seen as this idyllic figure, this invincible kind of figure living this great life. And even from the stature, I was always, you know, bigger than everyone. Everything going on great in my life, and probably in around that time it was, you know, I had a great life with loving family, supporting friends, and everything going well in around that time. So I guess I was lucky and privileged to be in that position.
Yeah, but is there at that stage a sense of separation from others, that you weren't doing the normal teenage things, that you were a cut above, a different path?
Yeah, and I guess I kind of had difficulty within that at the start, in particular, kind of the start of my secondary school days and first, second and third year, where I was trying to find myself. Everyone was trying to find themselves, of course, in a new area, new surrounding, and trying to, you know, find their own path in life. And I just thought, you know, I wanted something so deeply in my life to give me success, and that was in the shape of Gaelic football. And as my friends were going, say, for example, to the juniors at night looking for any amount of fake ID and drink they could get their hands on, I was going the opposite. I was going up to the Gaelic football pitches with my dad. And I guess only after a couple of years of people realising the drive that I had to want to succeed in my life in that shape, they kind of just let me go. And that was Shane. That was his life, and that's where he was going. So I became more comfortable within that, in that context, I guess.
So we have the picture now of the teenage superstar that people are looking at up there, aspiring to use the word idyllic life, mm-hmm. up on a pedestal a lot. And you make the Dublin Minors in 2011, still at a young age. The team loses the final All-Ireland to Tipperary, mm-hmm. but you're resolved the next year to go right back at it and right the wrong in the following season. But in January 2012, the trouble starts. Tell us what happened.
Yeah, it was, as you say, January 2012, the middle of fifth year, embarking on my second year at Dublin Minor football with that inevitable goal to right the wrong and go one step further. But little did I know in the middle of fifth year, when I was having these days where I was not quite up for the day, couldn't make sense of it. You know, I had either a Dublin match and out with my friends, out with my family, and I couldn't quite make sense of it. I couldn't, you know, bring myself to think, why am I feeling this way? Why can't I attack today? And as I referred to that pedestal-like figure that I was seeing up on, you know, I couldn't say it to anyone. I was thinking, if I said that to someone that I'm struggling within, you know, they'd think I was lying. Sure, what's wrong with you? You're living the idyllic life. You're playing for the Dublin Minor footballers. There's nothing wrong with you. So I kept it within. My only crutch, my medication at the time, was sport. It so happened to be football, maybe 5-6 times a week, as it were. And that was my only outlet at that stage, I guess.
Your football career is getting better and better all the time. Mm. But it seems that as that happens, your inner turmoil gets worse. And as you said, I think you used a phrase, a negative thought spiral, that you feel you're up there, mm-hmm. you've nothing to be complaining about, therefore why should I complain? And that there's a roller coaster. You have an unbelievably brilliant, powerful image at this stage in your book where you say that you felt there was two people inside you, one small in stature, frail and in desperate need of help, mm-hmm. and the other all-conquering and decisive. So can you explain that?
Yeah, I think the way I tried to describe it to people was the two lives that I was living. That kind of small man in stature, that frail kind of, you know, I would say depressed figure, as it were, in around that time. Little did I know it was depression. You know, so wanting to get the help that I so deeply needed, because it was getting ever worse as I progressed on in my life. But on the opposite side then, the other life that I was living, this all-conquering, idyllic figure, playing for Dublin in front of 82,500 people, having all the success in his life, I was torn between the two. And, you know, the bigger side, that kind of idyllic life was a winning over, because I felt like I couldn't let that other person out. So on the outside looking in, living this idyllic life, internally, I was struggling big time.
You mentioned there, you know, it's interesting to see how you were coping at this time, because it'll be 2 years of this struggle. You mentioned exercise as a medication, and people do often talk when they talk about mental health about, you know, exercise is a great way of dealing with things, but it's only a distraction, isn't it? Like, you know, the elephant in the room is how you describe that. You don't go near that.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I was kind of tiptoeing around it. I didn't directly kind of confront the elephant in the room, as you say. You know, it was so difficult in around that time. I was training 5-6 times a week. Those happy endorphins were literally just clinging onto a coattail of, you know, the survival mode that I was in. As I put it, I was only, you know, just surviving. I wasn't living at that stage. And I was only getting to a worse point in my life. Little did I know the manifestation of 2 years that I would get to. But that was the difficulty that I had within. As it was getting worse, my life was going on an upward curve. After the Dublin Minor footballers, then obviously, of course, being invited into the Dublin senior footballers still in school.
How do you remember that now? I mean, that's extraordinary thing to happen to an 18-year-old, winning All-Ireland Minor. You talk about going back to school then shortly before that, and that being a really tough time because the pedestal just gets bigger. Everybody's pointing at you going, there's Shane, he's absolutely flying it. Mm-hmm. And you get called up for the Dubs, the senior panel at such a young age. Mm-hmm. Were you able to experience the joy in that at all?
No, and that was the difficulty that I had in around that time, that joy that I should have been feeling when I had said it to my dad, who was, of course, as I say, you know, from my younger years, only wanting the best for me. And I don't think, you know, I didn't think he didn't believe in me, but it was quite a surprise at 18 years of age, still in school. I was now representing the Dublin Senior Footballers, and I could see the joy that everyone else had in my life, but I couldn't feel that. And that kind of just, as you say, that negative spiral continued on, because I was thinking, why can't I feel the joy that everyone else is feeling for me? And even my abiding memory of being, you know, invited into the Dublin Senior Football Panel, those morning gym sessions that we had at 6 a.m, you know, I was getting changed after the session and into my school uniform, and there's the likes of, say, Stephen Cluxton or Kevin Nolan, who was on the team at the time, you know, in their teacher's uniform per se, and they were like, you could be in my class if you're in my school this afternoon. So it was a rarity of the situation that I found myself in, and that I found real difficulty within, I guess.
Shane, it's worth pausing to remember at this point, and you're going through obviously your own internal issues, that you're also in at the ground floor of what would go on to be the most successful team in the history of Gaelic football. And you talked about the kind of pinch yourself nature of it. There's, you know, mm-hmm. people like Stephen Cluxton and Kevin McManaman and those kind of figures. Mm-hmm. Are they welcoming, or are they sort of, you know, laddie, you have to keep up here and match the standards that we're setting? Or what was that like?
Yeah, hugely. And I guess it was a kind of pinch myself moment, because I was still in school at the time. You know, I was 18 years of age, and you touched upon even Kevin McManaman. I remember my first kind of couple of sessions that were up with the Dublin Senior Footballers, and Kevin came over to me, and of course I know who he is, of course, you know, and he came over to me and shook my hand and said, I'm Kevin McManaman, nice to meet you, anything you need, just, you know, you can bend an ear with me, and that type of thing. And I was thinking, how is this guy so humble of everything he achieved? Only, you know, back in 2011, of course, the iconic goal that he had scored against Kerry, and here's me, you know, amongst these lads. But I guess the kind of humble nature of them is the mark of the men that they are in particular. You, of course, touch upon Stephen Cluxton, but, you know, the likes of Johnny Cooper, these lads kind of coming up in around that 2013 time.
But even with your struggles, you were able to appreciate it, because remember, you had been the kid all the way through, desperate to wear the blue and be part of it. And you know, that time, even though you're that year 2013, Dublin winning All Ireland, and you know, you're going through your own turmoil, did you feel you got to savor it at all? Or
no, at that time I didn't. And I guess when I look back, I, you know, it was maybe a regret at the time, and of course it was. You know, I was 18 years of age, living the idyllic life, getting my hands on a Sam Maguire, overachieving in my career to date. And I guess I look back at it as a piece of a motivation. You know, when I was on top of the Hogan Stand steps, I should have been feeling the elation that an 18-year-old should have been having in around that time. And I guess I look upon it as motivation to get back there and feel every bit of what I should have felt, because the numbness that I was experiencing, the lack of emotion I could attach to anything, simply, unfortunately, you know, wasn't there.
You have the week of celebrations after the All-Ireland that are so familiar to, you know, every year that any county that wins the All-Ireland, you kind of take part in that, but at the end of that week, as you've mentioned, that horrible thought enters your head for the first time that you may have to end it. Mm-hmm. That must be a frightening moment for any young man.
Massively, and I think that was, you know, the start of what was going to go on to be a horrible internal dialogue, a dialogue that I didn't want to have, but these voices in my head were saying, end it all now. And the more I had it in my head, the more I began to rationalise it. And as I say, it was six days after the All-Ireland final, you're thinking, you know, I'm riding a crest of a wave after a booze up in Dublin city centre for the whole week, and I should have been, you know, enjoying every bit of it, but I simply couldn't. And that moment where the first internal kind of suicide ideation.
Is that a tough time? You know, you're out socialising, crowds in Merrion Square. Mm-hmm. What are you feeling when everybody else is singing and drinking and dancing and having fun?
Numbness. And that's what it was, numbness. And I was so desperately wanting that kind of conveyor belt of emotions that should have been coming around, of happiness, elation, absolutely everything. I couldn't attach myself to it. I was there physically, mentally I was elsewhere. And kind of then looking back after all that kind of week of the elation of, you know, going on to Merrion Square and the singabouts that we had in Dublin City Centre and around that week, it was certainly difficult in around that time. And I guess that's why my mind brought me to that place of, you're not feeling the way you should be feeling, so end it all now. And that was a hugely scary moment for me.
You do start to think, I've got to reach out here, don't you? But then devastation hits your family from behind, totally catches the family unawares, doesn't it? Tell us about that.
Yeah, so winning around that time and building up the courage, okay, I need to speak up. As I said, these suicidal ideations weren't leaving my side and I didn't want to act upon them. So I was thinking, okay, I need to say something. I didn't know what I wanted to say, but I needed to speak up. And devastation did hit our family in around that middle of January. It first came in the shape of a friendly match down in Cork, as my mum and dad do right to this day. They travel right around the country. And they were down in this particular game for the under-21 Dublin footballers. And my mum receives a phone call off my uncle to say her dad had passed away. I was, of course, unaware of it at the time. I was playing a game and I followed in after coming off the team bus. And 1 o'clock in the morning, something not quite right here. Why are my mum and dad standing here? And it was where they met me with the news that my granddad passed away. And as I spoke about that numbness, that lack of emotion I could attach to anything, I simply said, I'm sorry, and I left the room. And it was the first kind of real warning sign for them, thinking I would have been so close to my granddad. I would have remember kind of visiting him every couple of weeks, where he should have told me I should have scored another 10 goals in whatever game I was playing in.
You couldn't process that grief?
No, absolutely not. And I should have. And that was the thing. Because I was so close to him, he was a huge kind of idol in my eyes from a very young age. You know, I aspired to be like, just like I did with my dad, I aspired to be like my granddad. He was so in tune with everything I was doing and I just couldn't attach any emotion to it. I simply kind of just acknowledged it and said, okay, and I left the room. And it's such a weird kind of reaction to have with such a piece of devastating news. And that internal dialogue that I was beginning to have, thinking I need to speak up, that was definitely quashed then around that time. And I began to build up yet again a couple of weeks after the passing of my granddad. But unfortunately, just 6 weeks after the passing of my granddad, my nanny had passed away too, both on my mum's side. So you can imagine then what I'm thinking internally. Whatever I'm going through in my life can't even compare to what my mum and family like are going through. So as I did for that previous 2 years, I shut up shop. I put up that poker face and I said absolutely everything was okay in my life. And I had football as that kind of crutch, that outlet to get me out of the dark hole that I was continuing to go in.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You talk about a constant repression of your identity, which means the inevitable is round the corner. Mm-hmm. Tell us about the day then of the Leinster under-21 final in April 2014.
Yeah, so a very, very pivotal time. And I guess a time that I look upon as probably a turning point in my life. The Leinster final, I had to look forward to that evening, as you say, down in Portlaoise. And on that Wednesday morning, my mum found me in a flood of tears. As the words crying, I don't know. The emotional tap was open and it just felt like I was so defeated here. I don't want to hide it anymore. And that was the first sign that she had seen, that she thought she was seeing at Christmas, right in front of her eyes, her 19-year-old son in a flood of tears. And it wasn't a whole lot that she had done in terms of, you know, saying much to me. But it was when she had sat by my side and put her arm around my shoulder that I knew that I had that listening ear right by my side that I so deeply needed for those previous 2 years. And I think it was a couple of hours sitting there, you know, weeping as it were. And my mum knew she'd need to break the trend, you know, bring me out for a couple of hours. So she contacted my middle sister, Mairead, who was off on that particular day. So she came over to the house and she brought me out for a couple of hours. And I still slag her to this day. The bright idea in her head was to bring me on a cliff walk out in the hills of Howth.
Right.
Probably not the most idyllic thing to do before a Leinster final. But again, it was similar enough to, as it were, my mum. I had that listening ear, that listening shoulder right by my side, and my head never left the gravel. I could just, you know, see one foot in front of the other, but just knowing that I had it right by my side. And as I came back into the car, the cliff walk, of course, came to an end. And I'll never forget, as I shut that door, I spoke about those kind of thoughts and feelings that were, you know, going on for those 2 years. They come bundling straight back in. And it was the first time I was thinking, maybe not even football can be my outlet at this stage, which was the inner turmoil that was going deep within. And I had my manager, Desi Farrell, at the time, from push a button away to say, look, I can't go through with this match this evening. I'm in such a bad way. And to this day, I don't know why I never went through with that phone call. So I went off home and I got my gear bag ready and I prepared for the match as I always did. And I met the lads in the team hotel for the pre-match meal. And even at that, you know, I was there in the team hotel, you know, the busyness of it, the buzz of a championship match in around that kind of time, I couldn't feel that. I'd maybe half a sup of water and that was it. I was off on the bus onto Port Laois. And I guess that kind of internal dialogue then was going deep within. I was on that bus. I'm sure probably people can relate kind of listening in that, you know, I sat myself up at the top of the bus, I had my headphones on, had a certain set of songs, maybe a certain playlist that brought me to a happier time and place, whether it be with a family member or friend. And I was playing it as loud as I could, solely to drown out the thoughts that were going deep within. And halfway through that bus journey, I contact my middle sister, Marie, to say, look, I'm in such a bad way here, I can't go through with this. And she texts me back, as my family did for those previous 2 years, right by my side, they want to see me out on the pitch. So I did. I arrived to the ground and I prepared for the match as they always do. I think I took half a sup of Luke's aid and that was it. I was off on the pitch, off onto Port Laois. And I say to this day, to be honest, it was the most satisfying 60 minutes of football I've ever played in my life. I was like a kid in a playground again. You know, I was running away from the thoughts that were going deep within. And if I'm right and remember, I think it was 2 or 3 minutes left in the game and we're 4 or 5 points up and I'm looking to the ref and you're probably thinking, you know, I'm telling him, blow the whistle up. And I was thinking the exact opposite. I was thinking, don't blow that whistle. I'm in heaven here.
Sanctuary for you.
That was my sanctuary. That was my safe haven. That was where, I guess, the internal dialogue that was going deep within couldn't get me, you know. And of course, inevitably, he blew that whistle. Unfortunately, we were victorious in the game. But added to that, it was actually awarded man of the match. As I'm walking on top of these steps, the pedestal-like figure that I referred to way back in those kind of early days, living this idyllic life yet again, collecting his Man of the Match award. Little did people know what was going on for me only 12 hours previous, in a flood of tears, my mum, my sitting room. They just seen this idyllic figure yet again, living this great life.
Literally up there on a pedestal. Mm-hmm. Afterwards, your family have booked you on a trip to Sweden to see your sister, Michelle. Why did they decide to do that it would be a good idea? And tell us what happened over there.
I guess the reason why they did was, you know, I have three sisters, Michelle, my older sister. Maybe I confided in her a bit more than I did with my other two sisters. And their kind of whole thinking was, whatever he's perceived to be hiding, he's going to tell his older sister, Michelle. He always has done it in the past, and he always did. But little did they know, I didn't know what was going deep within. As I said, the cloudiness was at an all-time high. I couldn't quite make sense of it. But nevertheless, today after the Leinster final, as I say, we book a trip to Stockholm and I went over there and I'd spoken with her, as I did with my mum and dad, only a couple of weeks previous, how I've been feeling this way for the last 2 years and in recent months of a thought of dying by suicide. So I guess for my sister hearing that so many thousand miles away, so deeply wanting to help me, you know, it was hugely devastating for her to kind of hear that her little brother, you know, at 19 years of age, wants no part of this world again. But that's all I could furnish her with at that stage.
Herself and Joey, who was her boyfriend at the time, just like your mother, though, they're there. Mm-hmm. And they're, people are maybe wondering, what do they do in this situation? What do they say? A lot of the time, it's just to listen.
Just to listen, yeah. And I think that would be my piece of advice for anyone kind of maybe thinking, how do I receive this information if someone kind of leans on me as a listening ear, a listening shoulder? I think for, as it were, my mum and dad, you know, as it just were with Michelle and Joey, they'd simply listened. All I needed was a springboard, a soundboard to kind of convey my emotions. I wasn't quite making sense of things, but at least I was getting it out in the opening around that time.
Your last night in Sweden then, you go for a walk, you have a low night and you go for a walk and you make a very important phone call to your friend Mo. Tell us about that and why it was so important.
I think in around that time, as I said, I was clinging on to things. I didn't want to act upon what I was thinking. And in around that time, I'd hit a huge low on that particular evening. So I went out on a walk, as you say, and I found myself on a bench park, hunched over, as was a familiar thing for me in around that time. And I'd made a phone call to him. And for the first couple of minutes, I couldn't get anything out. He was at the other end of the phone. I could hear him. And just the tears and everything was welling up, the lump in my throat. I couldn't quite make sense of what I was trying to tell him. It eventually did come out. And I guess that kind of phone call brought me back to reality. Where my mind was going simply wasn't reality. And I think he'd brought me back to a point in time. You know, he'd spoken about kind of the years previous of the great memories that we had, because I conveyed how I didn't want any part of this world. And he just then started speaking about the kind of things that, you know, were great memories for us as friends. You know, when we first became friends and in the middle of second year and a trip out to Germany. And, you know, that certainly brought me back within to think, I do want something part of this world, and I do want to be part of it, and I do want to experience these kind of highs that I did all those years previous. So that was a huge, huge turning point in my kind of, I guess, recovery and realising that I am a bit of something here. I do deserve to kind of continue on in my life.
Shane, you're no longer alone in this, but your toughest battle is still ahead of you. You make it back from Sweden. Your family helping you along the way with texts and that struggle between the rational and the irrational side of your mentality is going really, really hard at this point. But the next person you contact is so important in your story, isn't it? And it's your manager, Desi Farrell. What does Desi do at this point that's so crucial?
I guess he was the first person that was giving me the answers that I didn't have. As he spoke about that kind of, you know, Sunday evening as I came back from Stockholm, I texted him and I said, look, can I meet up with you for a cup of coffee? And he agreed. And of course, I met him the next day in Costa Coffee in Santry. And when I'd spoken to him for the 5 minutes that I did get to speak to him, you know, I was letting him in what was going on for me for those previous 2 years. And it was the first voice that was coming back that was resonating with me, that was relating with me. Of course, he had previous depression. So I was thinking in around that time prior to that conversation, I was the only one in the world going on what was going on for me, I guess. And it was such a surprise to hear, I can completely relate to you. I know exactly what you're talking about. And for me, I guess that was a small weight off my shoulders to kind of think, okay, I'm not the only one going through this kind of difficult time. And in around that time, he'd said, look, I'm going to set you up an appointment with a psychologist and we're going to get you out on the other side and you're going to begin your journey. And for me, that was a huge turning point. I guess that was the kind of beginning of, you know, me coming out on the other side, very much in a small way, but it was certainly a beginning, I would say.
So, but things still come to a head, though, a few days later. You're heading to Castleknock for a team meeting and you have a fateful panic attack. Despite the progress you've made, the small steps that you've made by talking to your family and talking to Desi and Desi engaging with him and almost starting out on a better road, why does it reach that crisis point?
I guess in around that time, as you say, after that meeting with Desi, it was the following day, as you say, we had that meeting out in Castleknock Hotel, and along the journey, you know, we trained in DCU that morning and we're on our way to Castleknock Hotel. And the reason why I did get to that point was, I guess, I didn't, you know, confront what was going on for me. Everything that I was trying to unearth, everything I was trying to make sense of in my head was still up there. And of course, this kind of panic attack had transpired and I blacked out. My next abiding memory was being woken up in St. Patrick's Mental Hospital. And I guess that was maybe, as I say, in another small way, my journey back from the edge, I guess, because I was beginning to then realise, okay, there's a way out here. I'm beginning to have kind of these conversations in the weeks and months that had transpired thereafter. It was scary. It was hugely scary. And I think when I was woken up after this panic attack and, you know, being woken up by these two softly spoken nurses to be told where I was, which was St. Patrick's Mental Hospital, and straight away, my kind of irrational mind went straight to the film Shutter Island. It's been one of my favourite films over the last number of years, and it still is to this day. And I guess that kind of irrational thinking of, I'm in a dark, dreary room, people in straitjackets, and that's where I thought I was when I heard this term mental hospital, because straight away I was thinking that film Shutter Island, that they painted this picture of what a mental institution is like. And of course, I quickly learned, you know, in the kind of minutes after going into the breakfast room, it was anything but.
How do you get from the person who goes in there and thinks that in 3 days' time they're going to walk out and play an All-Ireland semi-final, this irrational person processing things like that, to 11 weeks later a person who is on the road to recovery, or certainly at least understands where they've come from and where they've been a hell of a lot more.
I guess it was a huge learning process of ups and downs, as it is with depression. And in around that time at the start, you know, you're speaking about that irrational mind of kind of that All-Ireland semi-final that I thought I was going to play when I met my doctor and on my first day, saying, you know, the average stay of a patient is 2 to 4 weeks. And I was thinking of an All-Ireland semi-final to play here. I'm not staying here for 2 to 4 weeks. And I just didn't realise the point that I got to in my life, that I didn't want to live anymore. But yet I was still thinking football was the most important thing going on in my life. And only thereafter, I guess, I inevitably didn't play that All-Ireland semi-final, and coming to the realisation then thereafter that there's an awful lot more to life than football. Yes, it's given me a lot, and it has given me a lot of my life, and even thereafter, I guess. But at that time, I was thinking I need to kind of step up on this pedestal in a different way that I didn't quite think I had to step up on, in terms of kind of letting people know that this man living the idyllic life can go through difficult times, so can you. And that was a huge turning point in my journey, I guess, not only personally, but kind of then everyone else kind of realising I can go through a difficult time as well. So
it's a rough process, though, because you have breakthroughs and progression, but you also have really, you know, big reverses as well. And you talk about accepting the need for medication as feeling a bit of a failure there. And you even, like, there's a moment where you, again, you have suicidal ideations while you're in there. Just tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so that kind of thing of, you know, the ups and downs that I was experiencing, I kind of was in around that time thinking of suicidal ideation, and it wasn't leaving too far by my side. As I was trying to get this clarity, I still had kind of two steps back in some form of my kind of recovery, and one of which was actually being brought to what was called the secure unit at the time. At a particularly bad stage where I uttered out to the nurses that I didn't want any part of this world. I wanted to die. And I think for me, it was a learning curve when I went in there, because in the secure unit, as grim as it may sound, you know, your laces are taken off, your strings from your hood, and that's the reality of the situation. Purely for the protection mechanism of my own life, that's what had to be done. And, you know, even kind of looking back at that time, you know, I seen it as a huge learning curve. When I kind of even look back at the stories that we even had in there.
We talk about that decision to use your pedestal for good. Mm-hmm. And you've said there you want to come out and tell people about your story and make the decision to go public about it. Mm-hmm. Desi Farrell makes a statement, and you talk about this, you're going to be lighting a path now. Mm-hmm. What was that like when that was out there in the public, and suddenly it was all out there? Was there any sense of, did you have a lingering sense of shame about it, or were you now on a path of being proud of what you've been through?
I think I'd reached a point where I was proud of where I was at. It was the reality of the situation with where I was at, and you know, putting it out publicly was a huge kind of step in my overall process and that kind of weight off my shoulders. I wasn't aware of the reaction that I had gotten at the time because I'd gone off all social media. I was aware, of course, as he was making this public knowledge in the press release just prior to the All-Ireland final. But once I knew it was out there, it was kind of a big kind of sense of achievement for me and pride that, okay, I've let kind of people know with where I'm at. And I can certainly move on with my kind of ongoing process of a journey, I guess, back to a bit of normality in my life.
All the time, you're getting stronger, and you talk about how you change as a person in this time. Mm-hmm. Appreciation, as you mentioned there, that there's a life outside football. Mm-hmm. You talk about appreciation of the smaller things in life, like your obsession with coffee and things like that. So yeah. Why is that important to your story, that change of you as a person?
I think, and without wanting to use a cliche, I think, you know, all those experiences in St. Pat's, you know, shaped me into the man that I am today. And those kind of little kind of things, the small things that mean the most to you. And only when people go through the most difficult of times that they can relate to this, that it was the likes of like a little cup of coffee brought in from my sister, a little arm around the shoulder, a little compliment, a little text. Those small things were meaning so much to me, where once I was so naive and thinking, okay, football, 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 that's all that's going on in my life. And I was appreciating things around me. I was beginning to ask my mum and dad about their life, you know, things that were going on. I asked my dad to tell me about his soccer trips, and, you know, I probably regret it at the time, you know, go on for 2 or 3 hours about it. But
Dad stories,
yeah. And the whole lot. But it was great. It was so nice to be able to broaden my horizons. As my mum and dad, you know, once had said prior to my admission at St. Pat's, you need to broaden your horizons. And I'd only come to that realisation of what she really meant when I was in St. Pat's, of getting that bit of clarity of what exactly she was going on about in around that time.
And then you get the word from the doctor who sits you down and says, I think you're ready to go home. Mm-hmm. How does that feel?
Shock. I guess maybe a bit of disbelief that I thought it was just another kind of rigmarole of going in and checking up and how are you getting on and what are we going to do next week. And I was fidgeting around. I wasn't quite coherent in the room. And once I heard, you know, I think you're ready to go home, I certainly latched eyes with him. And just a broad smile, I remember that kind of came across his face. And I guess I got those butterflies in my stomach to, again, that kind of pride in me that I've done so much here. I'm ready to go out to the outside world, if you like.
So, Shane, 3 months after being ready to surrender your life and not feeling it was worth living, you see what you describe as a path ahead illuminated with hope. Does that feeling of accomplishment that you mentioned there, does it give you pride and happiness that you're able to actually experience as a genuine emotion in the way you weren't able to experience lifting the Sam Maguire a year previously?
Yeah, I think it definitely was. I think in around that time, for a couple of weeks even previous to that, I was beginning to feel these emotions again. I was beginning to kind of experience, you know, things that I should have experienced so many years ago, and just latching onto them, as I refer to kind of that conveyor belt of emotions. I was seeing that now, and I was beginning to be able to actually latch onto them. And that pride piece was hugely beneficial in kind of my overall kind of context of how far I've come here. 11 weeks, 3 months ago, I was a broken man, and I'm coming out a completely different person. And it definitely was something I could feel in around that time.
You get the call from Jim Gavin to come back into the panel, which I imagine is huge. How did you find re-emerging into society at that time after what you'd been through, and indeed rejoining the Dublin senior football panel at that time?
I think it was difficult. I think it always was. I'd never once thought when I came out of St. Pat's that it was just going to be rosy again. You know, I certainly knew that there was going to be an awful lot of learning for me. And not only for me, but my family, to let them in what, you know, what works for me, what doesn't. And in around the time of being brought back into the senior football team, I think I was, of course, hugely apprehensive. I was nervous of what the lads would think of me. You know, what have they heard? What do they think, you know, of the overall kind of thing of mental health? And coming back into my first session, I remember, as I spoke about those smallest of things, it was actually in the shape of Paul Flynn. When we had a gym session, it was my first session back, and I was there, you know, getting ready, and he'd come over to me and he'd tap me on the back and he'd say, "Good to see you back, mate." And for me, that was the biggest thing, as in that was all my worries kind of just wished away in one small tap of the back. And I'd said it to him years later, he goes, like, "I couldn't even remember that." And for me, as I spoke about, those smallest of gestures mean the most, and that certainly for me was a big stepping point back into the team.
And then you dropped off the panel in 2017, the senior panel, and that seems like that might be a big test for you. How do you handle these situations in those years?
I guess I looked upon even those kind of, you know, in different parts, as you say, after, you know, a couple of big matches where I found myself back in hospital after having a panic attack. And it was difficult, but I knew what that was the case. You know, I was kind of coming into a point where I was beginning to kind of feel sick of talking. And that certainly was a learning curve for me, that it wasn't a thing of I need to keep things within, because it gets to that point of having panic attacks and the likes of that. But the beauty of it was that I had psychologists along my side to be able to unearth why that was the case. And it wasn't getting into a point of putting away for 2 years. It was a couple of days and I could unearth it again with them. And even thereafter, of course, he spoke about kind of, you know, being dropped from the Dublin senior football panel. That was hugely devastating. Of course it was. It would be for anyone. But I was more versed to kind of adversity in my life, as I spoke about how it shaped me into the man I am today. I think that kind of spread across all facets of my life, whether it be my personal life, social life, or in this context, the sporting life, that a bit of adversity to face me. I need to kind of act upon it in a positive way. And I think I certainly did. I didn't go down a dark path again. I seen it as something to kind of work on and kind of try to get back in with them, as I did that year after then.
Is this where the mental health toolbox comes in handy? Tell us about that.
Yeah, so it was actually, the mental health toolbox, it was something I coined back in St. Pat's. I love that kind of visual of kind of having tools in that mental health toolbox. And I had so many things that I built up upon, particularly in St. Pat's and the time thereafter. And probably comes as no surprise if I was kind of named number one, of course it'd be physical exercise. It was what got me through 2 years of the worst time of my life. And it's something that gets me out of a dark hole at this particular juncture in my life as well, particularly in around these COVID times. And that playlist, that podcast, bring me to a happier time and place. And then having that kind of comfort of speaking to friends or family, if I am going through a bit of a stressful time in my life, to have that kind of leaning ear that I once never had. So I have plenty of tools in there. I love that kind of visual of a mental health toolbox. And I think it'd be a great kind of thing for a lot of people to pick up upon.
Yeah, it's a great image to have, isn't it? And you've used those things that you've learned in such an important way since then. That phrase you use about lighting a path for others and you know, helping those suffering in silence is how you've said it. Public speaking then becomes a big part of your life then. What has that experience done for you? What has it meant for you? And are you surprised that it's something that you've become, that's become such a big part of your life?
Mm. I think it has, and I think, you know, it came to me in a way that I didn't think it would. It was a message I received on Facebook back in 2017 to say, look, would you be interested in doing an event for us? It was in Kilkenny College, and I think maybe a crowd of about 100 people. And I was hugely nervous because I was never versed in the way of public speaking.
And you weren't a loud, kind of showy person?
No.
Listen to me, everybody, look at me kind of person anyway.
No, and the contrast between, as I spoke about, as I shied away from that pedestal so many years ago, I was now, you know, stepping up and upon it and using it in a positive light. And I guess for me, when I looked upon why I chose to do it, was because I wanted to kind of give that voice for people that were suffering in silence. I'd come such a long way in my path that I was comfortable enough to share my own experiences in the hope that I could have an effect on maybe one person in that room in that particular evening or day, whatever it may be.
What would you say to the 17, 18-year-old you now, if you were able to talk to that person, with everything you've learned in the meantime?
Yeah, and I think it's one thing. I'm very careful in saying about kind of having a regret in a story. I don't think I should have, but if I was to look it upon, one thing I would change is certainly to speak to that 17-year-old, 18-year-old self to say, speak up on day one. Speak up in the middle of fifth year, because the path that I went on thereafter, although difficult, was certainly a path worth travelling on, I guess. To look back upon that kind of time that I wish I'd have spoken up in the middle of 50, where I probably thought it was hormonal changes going on in my body. And that's what would be my advice to anyone, you know, no matter a problem, big or small, speak up, you know, get it off your chest. And I'm, I guess, testament to that, you know, you can go through difficult times and get out there after as well.
You had great help in your time, and you mentioned the GPA helping out, and I guess they're probably involved in that side of things and making sure these young athletes are, and organizations like them are catered for off, you know, off the field as well. Desi, obviously, St. Pat's, but it's frightening to think, Shane, isn't it, of people who don't have access to that kind of support when it's needed. And that's something you're quite passionate about now, isn't it?
Yeah, hugely, and I think that's one of the big reasons why I do this, is because I'm very much aware that I was in a very, very privileged position of being Dublin senior football, to have those contacts of the GPA, you know, having Desi by my side. A lot of people don't have that, and I've come to that realisation, you know, over the last couple of years, in particular the last couple of months, receiving messages of people, you know, in the same situation that I was, you know, in suicidal distress and being told, we don't have an appointment for you for 6 months' time. You know, that absolutely shouldn't be the case. And the reason why I'm trying to voice my kind of concerns about it is the government give it a lot of lip service, and not to get too much into it, but I think they need to kind of wake up into the realisation that we need to get our mental health services in check here, because this isn't a matter of a broken leg. It's life or death for a lot of people.
Let's sort of wind up then, Shane. Let's get back to football. You're back on the panel this year at the moment on a temporary basis, I think, or a sort of a, you know, see how it goes,
which
is great. How do you feel about football? Does it still drive you in the same way? Do you still dream of playing in front of 80,000 at Croke Park?
Hugely, yeah. And I think even kind of thinking back about that kind of motivational piece of wanting to feel something that I should have felt back in 2013, that was one of my motivations to get back amongst it with the lads. Hopefully it is the summer lifting Sam Maguire. And I guess, you know, football is a huge part of my life, but it's not the only thing going on. My love for football never diminished, and I guess as I have other aspects of my life going well, I can in turn play better football. And I think just being that kid in the playground again, you know, don't put too much pressure on myself. Just go out there and enjoy it for what it is. And I think that's the best way to kind of approach sport in general.
You never resented the game for twisting anything in your own psychology as a young man?
No, hugely not. And I think it was my safe haven. It was something that I still have as a crutch and as an outlet. So I never kind of look it upon as a negative, you know, those highs that I had that brought me to the desolate lows. It wasn't a causation of what I went through, I guess. So, I'm very much looking forward to getting back out on the pitch, and I think I speak for a lot of people saying that.
How did it feel watching the likes of, you know, Jack McCaffrey, Paul Mannion, Cormac Costello? I mean, even Brian Fenton, famously, he took your place in that 2014 under-21 final, and he's gone on to be, you know, he's regarded as one of the best players in the current era, maybe of any era. So many of them you could say the same about. Do you ever feel like that was my life, that was my chance, that should have been my story, or how do you view it?
I guess at the start I maybe had difficulty within that. It certainly wasn't from a jealousy point of view of what the lads went on to, because, you know, I love the lads. I've played alongside them for many, many years, and love to kind of see them going on into the players and the people that they are today. But I guess for me it was just maybe a motivating factor more so than anything. not look at it as a negative, look at it as a motivating factor to be wanting to kind of get back amongst those lads and the success that they have been lucky to have. And they're so humble in it with it as well. So I would love nothing more to be back alongside them and playing the game that I love, I guess.
Mm. Brian Fenton said a lovely thing recently after you speaking out around the book and getting back to Dublin action. He said he'd love to play alongside you. Mm-hmm. Footballer of the Year, of course,
yeah.
In your position. That must be a nice thing to hear.
Yeah, I think I returned that sentiment to him. I would love to play alongside what I think is going to kind of go down, or he is going to go down as one of the greatest footballers of all time. And I think that's just testament to the work that he puts in and that he has. And he didn't have it all rosy back in his days. He wasn't part of the minor panels as I were. And look what he's gone on to do. So I would love nothing more to be, you know, playing alongside him. And what a fantastic man outside of football as well.
Well, I'm sure Dublin fans will agree with that. Fans of other counties will completely disagree on that score. But it's a brilliant thought, and look, we'll see what happens on that front. But finally, Shane, it's funny you touched on it there. What's your role now outside of football as a public speaker with the book, which is a brilliantly told account of your story that will resonate with so many people. Mm. It feels like, you know, you are back on a pedestal.
Yeah,
back on, you know, up there, people looking at you. But I guess it's for very different reasons this time. And does it feel very different?
It does. I think it feels different in terms of that pedestal that I was seen back upon in 2013 is, you know, probably seen upon it again in these days of 2021. But it's different. You know, I have a completely different mindset. I'm better able to kind of handle this pedestal that I'm up on. I'm very proud to be up on. And I guess I'm trying to just give a voice to absolutely everyone, as you say, through the book or through my talks. And I'm hoping to just be one of many, many thousands of people that will come out with their stories and echo that sentiment that it's okay not to be okay.
Shane, thanks so much for telling us your story.
Appreciate it.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.